today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K.Y.'s Whitehead here again to have another conversation with you about some of the stories that matter. Folks, today's topic is up to you. It is similar to our weekly wrap where we open up the phone lines and we allow you to put whatever you like on the table. It is such a busy an active time in American history. But we actually have our president right now, our former president, excuse me, who's being impeached again. This time for high crimes and misdemeanor. Did President Trump stir up the base that then went and tried to take over the Capitol, tried to collapse democracy, the failed insurrection attack that we talk about? Does it rest at the feet of Donald Trump? It's interesting because the Democrats have put up a fight. I mean, they have come out swinging every step of the way. And yet, there's still some Republicans who are not convinced. And I think that the road to get Donald Trump removed from ever being able to run for office again, being able to tap into his pension, take all of that away, the staff that's guaranteed to former presidents, to just get him removed from the rosters, done, blotted out. I think the road to doing that is a much higher one than the Democrats will be able to climb. I think what we're doing right now is just making a note for history. Like, we are trying to go down in history saying that we don't agree with what Donald Trump did. We don't agree with the way in which Donald Trump refused to participate in a peaceful transfer of power. We don't agree with folks coming into Washington, D.C., storming into the Capitol, shouting things like, hang Mike Pence, or we're here to shoot Nancy Pelosi. That is not who we are as a nation. We don't agree. And that is what we're watching happen now in Washington, D.C. I don't think Trump's going to be blotted out. I don't think he's going to be convicted. I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think you have that many Republicans. I think we need like 16 or so to come over to the side, and every Democrat has to vote yes in order for this to happen. I think it's just a statement. It's a way of kind of putting our foot down and saying this particular America, the one in which we can take power through a coup, the America of white supremacy, the America of separatism, the America where whiteness is continued to be put into the middle, the America that needs to be taken back from black and brown people, the America where whites are able to do whatever they want with impunity, that America doesn't exist anymore. And well, it shouldn't. I mean, I think we are past time for that America to be an America of the past. I think we need to live in the new America, the black, brown, white, and Asian America, the America where men, women, the LGBTQIA community, where everybody can live in harmony, the America where all voices are allowed to be at the table. And it's not about whether you agree with someone's lifestyle choices. You don't have to agree. But you do have to give them space at the table, even if it means you have to give up your seat. See, that's what Shirley Chisholm was trying to get to when she talked about bringing your own chair. The problem was when Shirley Chisholm was back in office, going back, of course, to 1968, this notion that white men didn't want to make room at the table. Shirley Chisholm put forth the argument, they don't have to make room at the table. The table doesn't belong to them. You make the room at the table. If they won't give you a chair, you bring your own. If they won't make the space for you, then you create the space. If they won't recognize you, then you stand up and you don't stop talking until they do. When they want you to move, you stand tall and say, I will not move. You must move because I'm not going anywhere. So whether or not you agree with the direction of America, this is where we're going. There is a browning of America that is taking place. Whether or not you agree with it, whether or not you see yourself there, it doesn't matter because it's happening. And that's what we're watching play out in Washington, D.C. I want to put that on the table today. I want to talk about COVID-19, because we delved into this a little bit yesterday, and we have a guest who's going to be joining us today. A pediatric infectious disease specialist will join us to talk about COVID-19 and the vaccination for our children. It came out that the CDC is pushing for children to go back. I would argue that the tide is turning. Here's what I think is interesting. And I went back and I looked at all the information about COVID-19 over the last year. I went and checked out my Facebook feed and my Twitter account from the last year of thinking about how we've been wrestling with COVID-19. And we've reached a point now where there is a feeling that the tide is turning, that they're watching the number of infections begin to slowly go down. They're watching the number of hospitalizations begin to slowly go down. I suspect, though I am not an infectious disease specialist, I don't study COVID-19 at all, except as a layperson, I suspect we're going to see one more bump coming after the Super Bowl, because I think people live their best lives over Super Bowl weekend. So we may see another bump. But the way that they're reporting it now, and this is the part that got me, they said, look, COVID-19 is now endemic, which means you're going to have to learn how to live with it. You must learn how to live with COVID-19. And that's what I want to talk about in this first hour. How do we live with COVID-19? Because the way we've been living, I would argue, really hasn't been living. It's really been kind of dodging, kind of moving, kind of hiding, kind of realizing and believing and accepting that, okay, COVID-19 is a reality, but if we just hold on, it won't be here any longer. I say that because if you're still someone who is inside and you're saying you're not going to send your children to school, since COVID-19, according to the scientists and researchers, is here to stay, then what's your plan? COVID-19, they said, is endemic. You must learn to live with it. So with that in mind, what is your plan for moving forward? Because you can't tell me that you're honestly thinking that you're going to stay in the house from now until the end of time, that you're never going to let your children out of the house because we've got COVID-19 and we're not going to take the vaccine, so we're just going to stay inside. I'll homeschool my children. I'll work from home until when? COVID-19, experts are saying, is endemic, that we actually have to learn how to live with COVID-19. We've got to learn how to negotiate around COVID-19. We've got to learn, just like people had to learn to live with the flu. See, we didn't, because by the time we came along, the flu was a part of our culture, a part of our lexicon, a part of our reality. You took the flu shot or you didn't. You got the flu or you didn't. We learned how to live with it. We didn't have to learn how to adjust to measles, mumps, rubella, or polio. I mean, these are things we just got the vaccination, or your parents put you in line for the vaccination. You got the shot. For the MMR, which at that time was separate, you got a measles shot and a mumps and rubella shot. Now it's one shot. You got your shot for polio and whatever else they vaccinated us for. I will be very honest in telling you that I don't think my parents, as astute as they are, I don't think they know exactly what I was vaccinated for. I think they heard it. They signed the paper. I got the shot at school. You got the sugar cube and you moved on. Because that's what you were told to do if you wanted to keep your child in school and you didn't want your child to have to deal with polio or measles. They now have a chickenpox shot. I didn't get a chickenpox shot when I was a child. Like many of you, I just simply got the chickenpox. And the chickenpox is highly contagious. When I got it, every single person in the household got it except my parents. We were four children. All of us got the chickenpox. And it was everywhere. In our hair, you know, all on our neck, our legs, our feet. Chickenpox were, because we were scratching and moving it around, highly contagious. We got it. We moved through it. Well, my sons had to take the varicella, which is the chickenpox vaccine. I was surprised when the pediatrician talked to me about vaccinations and there was a chickenpox vaccine on the table. I'm like, well, what about just getting it and having them move through it in the same way I did? I don't remember my parents ever talking about shingles, and now shingles is a thing. My mom saying, oh, we got to talk about getting the shingle shot when you get, I think, over 60 or something. New things that are happening. We're not questioning any of that nearly as much as we're questioning this COVID-19 vaccination. So if you are planning not to take it, and there's no judgment here, you do what's best for your family. If you are saying, I'm not going to even get my child vaccinated, again, you do it, whatever's best for your family. COVID-19, they're saying, is endemic, which means it's going to be here probably for years to come. What is your plan? If you're saying you want to wait until there's herd immunity, words, let's be clear, I never even thought about herd immunity until COVID-19. I also never thought about being asymptomatic or symptomatic. I mean, things are all part of like the new vocabulary that we've all picked up in this last year. So if you're saying, I'm going to wait it out until herd immunity, well, what doctors are saying is that's going to be bloody, it's going to be messy, and you're going to have a lot more people die while we wait for herd immunity. Which, by the way, when Dr. Fauci first talked about herd immunity last year, he said 60% of the population. That's what I heard early on. And then sometime near the beginning of September or so, they started talking about 65, 70% of the population. When we had Dr. Fauci on our show come in December, he was saying 75, 85% of the population. And now we just heard that they're talking 90% of the population needs to either be vaccinated or have gotten COVID-19 and possibly built up some type of antibodies to it in your system. You're not going to be immune to it. You can catch it again and again and again. But maybe your body will learn how to fight it over time. We don't know why, because it's new. COVID-19 is a year and a couple of days old. It's new, brand stinking new. And they're still trying to figure it out. COVID-19 is new, but the novel coronavirus is not. See, that's the part I had to understand. That was the new part for me. 19 is new, but coronavirus is not. That they've been planning for how to beat the novel coronavirus for a long time. So when COVID-19 happened, they just shifted and they were able to move. The CDC recommends 5 strategies to reopen schools. They're saying, look, schools must open. COVID-19 cases are declining across the U.S. Now, this just came out from the CDC. It came out at 2:40 p.m. today. It just broke. This is hot off the press information that I'm giving you here. Hot off the press for us, for you to consider. Just to consider. They said at this point, COVID-19 cases are declining across the United States, but U.S. deaths remain high. So the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention saying it's now time to reopen schools. And they released 5 key mitigation strategies for returning to in-person school safely. I want to lay these out, and then I want to go to a story that was in the New York Times Magazine that talked about Rhode Island and how Rhode Island kept their schools open. And according to the principals in Rhode Island, it was messy. It was hard. A lot of people got sick, teachers and students. But they stayed open. They made the decision to remain open through the worst thus far of the pandemic. How is it going to be in less than, 2-3 weeks or so? March 1st. Is what Dr. Sonia Santelices has said in terms of babies going back to school, March 1st. And I want to be clear that today is February 12th. No, I'm sorry, March 1st. Today is February 12th. The thing about February is only 28 days, right? So before you know it, February, Black History Month, 28 days of blackness will be done, and your baby, if your baby is in kindergarten, first, second, third, fourth, fifth grade, if your baby's in ninth grade or 12th grade, your baby is expected to be back in school. Now, you can continue to keep your child home. You can do that. Unless your child's school, hear me when I tell you. Unless your child's school is equipped with something called the OWL, O-W-L. Now, I don't know anything about this technology, but let me break it down for you. There is this new technology that came on the market that some private schools, some county schools were able to afford called the OWL. And you set it up in the middle of the class. It's a camera. It sits in the middle of the classroom. And when someone talks in the classroom, the OWL picks up on that person's voice and it swivels to the person talking. So that way I can be at home and I can be doing my thing at home, but I can remain a part of the class. When I want to speak, then my picture comes up on the big screen, and so everybody in the classroom can see me. And if little Rashida wants to talk in the classroom, then the OWL swivels to Rashida so everyone can hear her and see her. If your school does not have the OWL, I'm trying to figure out how your child's school is going to offer education to both the children in front of them and the children on the computer. That's what I'm wondering. Now, I speak as someone who's currently doing it. See, I don't speak of what I've heard. I'm speaking of what I know. I am currently one day a week teaching in person. But I am teaching in person on Zoom. Why? Because half of my students are either at home or in their dorm room, they're on Zoom. The other half are in front of me. And so when I walked into the classroom the first day, I'm like, well, I don't have an OWL, so how do I do this? So here's what I'm doing. And I know this is not going to make sense, but I'm going to go ahead and put it out here. I have everybody log on to Zoom. So we are in person on Zoom. Why? Because if I move around, I'm moving out in front of the camera. So the students who are on Zoom can't hear me. And if little, you know, Pashada talks in the back of the classroom, unless Pashada is on Zoom, how do I hear Pashada in the front of the classroom? How am I projecting all the way to the back of the classroom? I can't move around. So we're in person on Zoom. Is that what we're talking about doing? Are the schools, and this is a question for Dr. Sonia Santelices and principals, are the schools equipped with what they need to run both in-person and virtual learning at the same time in the school? Now, we got to talk about that. So are we talking about babies bringing their computers with them so they can go online while they're in school? Can the school itself handle that much technology at one time? How do we navigate and negotiate around that? And how do we do it in March? The reason why I focus on that is because it's not like it's September and we have a little bit of a buffer time, right? See, in September, if we had gone back, we could have started and stopped, succeeded and failed a number of times. And by the time we got to this point in the school year, we would have been up and rolling. When we start in March, how much leeway do we have for things to be up and down, starting and stopping before we get to the end of school? The CDC said, here are the 5 key mitigation strategies for returning to in-person school safely. 1 is the universal and correct wearing of masks. Now, I'm going to lay each one of them out, and I got to stop and give a little commentary each step of the way, because this is going to be our conversation when we open up the phone lines in just a second. The CDC said that one key mitigation strategy is that everybody has to wear a mask. Now, I want you to think about that. Line it up with the new information that just came out from the CDC that now everyone needs to be double masked. So what you're saying is I need to send little Pashada to school in 2 masks? So I need to have my 4th grader, my 3rd grader, my 9th grader sitting in school all day long in 2 masks, not 1. Because the CDC, if I'm not mistaken, Justine, am I right or wrong? The CDC is saying you need to have on a medical grade mask, that's the first layer, and then you need to have on a cloth mask as a second layer. So there are no entry points anywhere on your face. So now my baby has to sit all day in school with the mask up underneath their eyes, right? All the way to the bottom of their chin. One mask and then a second mask. Okay. That's going to be a problem. I don't know about you, but I've been double masking for a minute here, right? I mean, I've been double masking because I'm like, I thought there was a problem a while ago. It is hard to breathe in a double mask. It is. I put it on. I have my KN95 on, and then I put the cloth mask. I have one that Sister Tawanda Jones gave me with, you know, Tyrone West's name on it. I put my cloth mask on it, and it is hard to breathe. I also find that I'm constantly adjusting them on my ears because the two masks tend to pull off. And I find it really hard when I have my glasses on because now I have my glasses sitting over two masks. You got to have the steel piece over your nose. So we're talking double masking for every single teacher and student. That's number one. Number two, physical distancing. Students haven't seen each other since last year. Haven't seen their favorite teacher, their best friend, their play buddy at all. So we want them to be in school and stay away from each other. The recommended distance is 6 feet. So I'm trying to figure out in our schools where we had students 30 plus deep, how do we space them out 6 feet? So which means that we have to have fewer children in each classroom. Which means we have to have fewer children in the building. Are we just banking on the fact that half of them will stay home? Number three, washing hands. Now, look, unless Baltimore City has undergone a major construction project, and maybe they did, I don't know, but Senator Jill P. Carter and Dr. Lawrence Brown, the author of The Black Butterfly, have spoken repeatedly about lead poisoning with our children coming from the pipes, which is why they can't drink from the water fountains at school. So will the water that they're washing their hands with be the lead-based water, or are they doing something different? That's three of the five mitigation strategies. There are two more. When we come back from break, I'm going to give you the two more, and then I want to open up the phone lines to you. Where do we go from here? How do we send our children back to school in less than 2.5 weeks? This is Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. Stay with us. Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. Folks, we're talking about the fact that the CDC is saying, look, we have cases going down, this declining across the U.S. U.S. deaths still remain high. COVID-19 is now endemic, which means it's going to be with us for a minute. We got to get back to normal here. We got to get the babies back in school. That's the battleground. They released five key mitigation strategies. I've talked about three of them. The universal and correct wearing of masks, physical distancing, and washing hands. Here are the last two. Cleaning facilities and improving ventilation. And so I am wondering if Baltimore City is going to be able to, and I'm not saying they can't, I just don't know, are they able to disinfect the school throughout the day? Here's why. You disinfect at night and the students come in. At some point between 9 a.m. and 2:30 p.m. or 3 p.m., there's got to be another cleaning. So what's their plan for cleaning throughout the day? Someone has said to me that they're expecting teachers to clean up throughout the day, which means that not only are you teaching and you're taking care of yourself, you're also wiping stuff down. Like, that's going to be part of what you have to do as well. Improving ventilation. Now, there was some talk that money has been put on the table to bring in these systems for the rooms, like humidifiers or whatever, to help with the rooms, because you really can't have expected Baltimore City to have upgraded the HVAC systems for all the schools. And if they did, then I'm wrong. Tell me I'm wrong. But I haven't seen that type of construction happening in the schools, nor have I read about it at all. And then the fifth thing is to do contact tracing, isolation, and quarantining. So if little Pop-Pop gets on the bus in the morning, because that's an area that they're not talking about. I'm not sure if they take into account that here in Baltimore City, babies are getting on the bus to get to school. So they got to get on the bus. They're going to have to socially distance on the bus, get to school. And what if my second grader shows up at school with a fever? What's the plan for isolating my baby, keeping them there? If there's no nurse at school, who does this fall under? Who will take care of my child until I can get there or not? What is the plan? Are you going to shut only classrooms down? But if I'm moving through the building, are you going to be opening and closing? So the CDC is saying that if you put these five key mitigation strategies in place, then you will be able to safely reopen schools. The way it stands to me is that maybe we are not ready. Maybe not yet that we're ready, but we do have to do this. In just a minute, we're going to be joined by Dr. James Campbell. We have a pediatrics infectious disease specialist who's going to join us to talk about this. But until he does, I want to ask you, where do you stand on getting your child vaccinated? You heard what the CDC has said. COVID-19 is endemic. It's going to be with us for a while. They've also said that they want schools to be open. We've also heard evidence that it's going to be difficult to run schools virtually and in person at the same time. If we think teachers are stressed now, imagine how much more stressful they're going to be having to provide instruction for people who are at home on Zoom and people who are in front of me. I don't know what classroom management is going to look like. I mean, I guess that's out the door at this point. Am I going to spend my day telling children to keep their mask on, to move away from each other, to move away from me? Like, how do I move through the classroom? Are they doing training with teachers on how to teach in this environment? Because the ways you did it before, you're not going to be able to. You can't rely on the power of your voice to the back of the room anymore. You're going to be double masked. You can't rely on the ability to go and stand beside a child who may be misbehaving because you got to stay 6 feet away. You can't rely on the one-on-one conversation to see what's happening with the child. Why? Because you got to stay 6 feet away and keep that distance at all times. We have a clip from NBC News about children who volunteered to take the vaccine. I got to hear this, and so do you. Let's take a listen to it.
Caleb Chung is a typical 12-year-old, but may be key to ending the pandemic.
I'm really excited for that.
He's one of more than 2,000 adolescents enrolled in Pfizer's clinical trial for the COVID-19 vaccine.
Do you feel like a hero?
Kind of. I know that doing this vaccine trial could really has the potential to really help out in the world of children.
While children aren't at high risk for developing severe illness and are thought to spread the virus less than adults, they make up almost a quarter of the population, so vaccinating them could be vital to reaching herd immunity.
It is critical at this point to start vaccine trials in children before the natural virus itself mutates. We need to start vaccinating children sooner than later.
Dr. Anthony Fauci hopes it will be by summer, but dosing for a teenager may be different than a toddler, and the timeline for younger children is still unclear. Pfizer is studying 12 to 15-year-olds now and will begin trials for children 5 to 11 next. Moderna doesn't expect its trial results for those under 12 until 2022. For parents, enrolling kids can be a big decision. Caleb's dad is a pediatrician.
My initial instinct was one of excitement, and of course, I also needed to talk to him and to make sure that we made that decision together.
For Pilar Manson, it was an easy decision.
Participating in a trial has a big impact on stopping this pandemic. And it's a way that we can impact people when usually we can't as kids.
Kids rolling up their sleeves and doing their part, hoping their peers aren't far behind.
Okay, so that was a clip from NBC. Now, I need to talk to you. 410-319-8888 is both an observer to this whole situation, and as a mom, okay? So as an observer, yes, you're absolutely right. We need to vaccinate children before it mutates. The only way we can get the vaccinations into the arms of all the children is to have a couple of children, 2,000 according to Pfizer, who are willing to go into a trial study so we can study what's going to happen to them when they take the vaccine. That is someone that's an observer, understanding. I get it. As a mom, I'm listening to a 12-year-old say, yes, I'm all in. You wouldn't be all in unless somebody who's an adult, a parent, is saying, look, let's do this. You are making a sacrifice for the country. The first child that you heard was an Asian American child. The second child was a little white girl. Look, y'all, are you willing? 410-319-8888. Are you willing to sign your child, 15 years of age and younger, up for the COVID-19 vaccination trial? And let's be clear. I'm going to say it, and then I'm going to go to Arden. Let me say it, because I got to say it. They're going to come knocking on our door next. Remember? Remember when they were talking about the trial studies? What do they keep saying? They said, we need more black people. We need more black people. We need y'all to sign up for the trial study. We had Dr. Wabowski on the show. He was in the trial study. We need more black people. So you know the next wave of ads and pushes going, we need more black children. Give us your children. Give us your parents. Give us your sisters. We need more black people to go in the trial studies. They want our children. Like, y'all, why do they want our children? Because they have to study the impact on black children. More black children are dying from COVID-19. Yes, they want our children. And as a mom, I you know what? Let's just go to the phone lines. 410-319-8888. Ardent's on the phone, a new caller from Baltimore. How are you?
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment for a second. I think you're totally right about not double masking young children. I think it's, you have to breathe. I think it's going to be deleterious to their health not to get enough oxygen over time. And I think about the Asian countries. I've been wearing masks for, gosh, so long, as you know. And I bet they don't double mask their children. I just bet.
So now, given the fact, Arden, that the CDC is saying that a single mask is not enough, that double masking right now is the only way to protect you from these new mutated strains of COVID-19, the one from South Africa, Brazil, and the UK, you still would think we just need to single mask?
Yes. Didn't they just backtrack about a week ago? They're back and forth. Everybody's has a different opinion. I wouldn't put two masks on my little child. I just hate to see them as it is on little children. But as I said, the Oriental countries have been doing it for a really long time. I think we should see what they're doing. Why not take clues from other societies as to how they're handling contagious diseases?
Okay. I appreciate you, Arden. I appreciate you. Thank you for calling. We have CJ on the phone from Glen Burnie. CJ, how are you?
Yes. How are you, Dr. K?
I'm doing well.
Just
thank
briefly,
you.
I was listening to you talking about vaccinating children. I think we need to be very careful about rushing into that because we just really started vaccinating adults and don't really know the outcome of that. First of all, I guess the children, because they're minors, they have to have the parents' permission, written
right.
permission, for them to be vaccinated. I remember before they had all the vaccines for measles, mumps, and rubella, we had measles, mumps, chicken, we had everything before they developed the vaccines, you know?
Right.
And, of course, that's all accepted now. I'm just a little concerned of them rushing into this too quickly with children. I think they need to kind of see what's going on with the adults first before they start doing that. I'm just, you know what I'm saying? I just have concerns about them moving too quickly with that.
Okay. Let me ask you this, CJ. So they're saying that what they just said, that the concern is that if it mutates again, if our children are not vaccinated and we're sending them back to school, then we could be setting ourselves up in a situation where it's going to mutate and then our children will be carriers of this new mutation that the vaccine we're currently taking won't protect us against it.
hadn't heard that. Okay, well, then in light of that, then maybe they do need to start vaccinating.
Yeah.
But they, you know, I hadn't heard that, because certainly we don't want to have another situation nationwide and then worldwide, you know, with that. The situation is difficult enough as it is now.
Yeah.
So in light of that, then maybe they should. You know, I certainly would not like to see children start getting the coronavirus being sick. That would be demonstrable, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
That would be horrible, I think.
Now, would you let your children 15 and under participate in the trial study? Because not only, CJ, do they need 12-year-olds and 10-year-olds, they're going to need babies, too.
Oh,
Because they have to test it. I mean, they can't really give it to a baby until it's been tested.
I have to look at that really, really closely. I'm a nurse for 40-some years. I've seen everything from birth to death and everything in between.
Yeah.
I'd have to really look at that. My children are all grown. They're all 30-some years old. So I don't have any children, you know, under that age. But if I did, I'd have to really kind of look at that and, you know, look at the pros and cons of that. But certainly we would not want to have, as we've had, all these people, you know, developing the coronavirus. I think it would be horrible if children started getting that. I would not like to see that. So in light of that, then maybe they do need to start, you know, doing that, you know, just to prevent that large amount of children being infected. I think that would be worse, just as bad as having all these adults who developed it.
Okay.
I would hate to see that.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right.
Let me just say, folks, that we're going into new territory here, not uncharted territory, but new territory. If you remember, with the 1918 flu pandemic, the biggest population who they were catching the flu and dying from it were children under the age of 16. That was the big concern when COVID-19 first started making its way around. And they realized that unlike the flu pandemic of 1918, it is not situated with our children, but it's situated with our elders, which is why when they rolled out the COVID-19 vaccination, they rolled it out for the oldest members of our population. Whereas if you switch it to 1918, when they rolled it out, it was for the youngest members of our population. So the concern is, if we don't vaccinate the babies and it continues to mutate, then our babies could bring home a new strain of COVID-19 that the vaccine that we've taken won't protect us against getting it, and we see the death toll rise again. So would you put your child in a trial because they need your child and your baby? Ooh, 410-319-8888. Dwight's on the phone from Baltimore. Dwight, how are you?
Doing bad, okay.
I'm doing well,
you know,
thank you.
Bad, okay. I think that they've been out of school this long. Why not just let them stay out of school the rest of this year? That way, that would give them time to prepare them schools properly for what is needed to be done, you know, and it would give them chance to do what, really, like I said, what they need to do, and it would give the parents a chance to decide what they want to do as far as getting their kids vaccinated. See, they're moving too fast, right? You know how to say, I used to work for the Department of Education for 30-some years, right? So I know how they operate, you know what I mean? Sometimes they move too fast, and then when they make a mistake, then it's too late then, right, you know? So I think they need, most of the kids graduate in May when they do graduate, and the ones that don't graduate just stay in until June. So they need to go ahead and let them stay on out. That way they get more time, but the schools are not properly clean like the schools are, right? Because if they still had a medical custodian, you got day shift custodians,
right,
night shift custodians, and they can't do it all
so
by themselves.
So maybe it's best,
you know,
just to keep them
you
home,
got
right?
A lot of big schools that, you know, they just ain't ready yet, you know?
All right. Thank you so much, Dwight. I'm joined now by Dr. James Campbell. He's a professor of pediatrics and pediatric infectious disease specialist at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. He's the lead for the maternal child clinical trials section of the Center D Vaccine Development. And Dr. Campbell was named in Baltimore Magazine's 2019 Top Docs list. Dr. Campbell, welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So we have questions about this vaccination and our children. And with the conversations that we've been having, we know we weren't quite ready. But now information has come up that Pfizer is running a trial study with at least 2,000 children under the age of 15. So let's start with that. Where are we with the COVID-19 vaccination for children under the age of 15?
Yeah, thanks for asking about it. We've been pushing from the American Academy of Pediatrics and from lots of pediatricians to try to get these vaccine studies started and finished so we can look at the data. So Pfizer already, their vaccine is already authorized and recommended down to the age of 16. And they had a study that was from 12 to 17-year-olds, but at the time they went for authorization back in December, they only had enough data on the 16 and 17-year-olds. So now they've accrued all of that additional data that they need down to the age of 12, and we're hoping that when they put in for licensure, like the next stage of authorization, that they can get it all the way down to age 12. So they've already finished that study. I mean, the people are still in the study, but they have the data now to be able to present it to the FDA. So that's good. We may have that one vaccine down to middle schoolers soon. Moderna, which is the other one that has authorization for adults, they have an ongoing trial of 12 to 17-year-olds that's about the same size as the Pfizer trial, a few thousand children. And those results are not available yet. So, you know, I don't know exactly how long it's going to take, but probably in the next couple of months, we'll have a second, hopefully a second vaccine that's been shown to be safe and effective down to 12. Now, in terms of younger children, those are just getting started now. So both Moderna and Pfizer have plans and of starting very soon, pediatric trials where we start. We keep inching down in age. That's the usual way we do it. Start with teenagers, then move to school age, you know, younger school age kids, then down to toddlers and infants. So those are all in the works and coming soon.
So what questions should I be asking? If my children were young, and my children thankfully are much older, but you know, if I had a 12-year-old, if I had a 7-year-old, if I had an arm baby, what are some of the questions that I should be asking my pediatrician if I'm looking at my child getting the vaccination?
Yeah, so it's the same kind of questions that you'd be asking for other vaccines, and that is, you know, What have the studies shown? How well does the vaccine work for children this age? What kind of side effects can I expect from the vaccine? How long does the vaccine protect you from disease? You know, if you have a child who maybe you think might have higher risk of having severe disease, then you may be wanting to ask, like, should my child be getting the vaccine earlier because of maybe having heart disease or having lung disease or having an immune compromised disease? So I think those are the important questions to ask. And we as pediatricians, we're typically very knowledgeable in all of the vaccines because it's a lot of what we do.
Right.
So I think, you know, as these pediatric information about the vaccines for children starts accumulating, then the pediatric providers will have more and more information to give parents.
What about the vaccine trial? So we just listened to a clip from NBC, and we heard it from at least two young people, and according to Pfizer, they have like 2,000 in the trials. So I know that one of the things we saw with the last round of trials is they were looking for more African Americans to participate. Mm-hmm. So as an African American parent, what should I be thinking about if I want my child to participate in the trial? Like, I do want to have the vaccine available, but there's a little bit of fear there about having my child be first in line for this.
Yeah, in the trial itself. I think, you know, the people, both adults and then parents of children who choose to join the research trials, they do a phenomenal service for the rest of us. So, you know, people look at us like me, you know, people like me who actually run the trials as doing that service. But a huge portion of the service is from the families and the people who choose, you know, to join these trials. And what does it mean to be, quote, in a trial? It means like if you were to say, oh, you know, you have a 12-year-old and there's a study going on of 12-year-olds, you would show up at a site like ours at the University of Maryland, and your child would be screened, meaning we would check to make sure that they're, quote, eligible, like are they the right age and are they not on certain medications and do they not have certain medical problems and things like that. And then the child would have, typically they would have a nose swab like you would for a test for COVID and have their blood drawn before they get vaccinated. And then they would get the vaccine or they would get placebo. So we do what we call random assignment. And that means some of the children get vaccine and some of them get placebo, which is just salt water. And then they are then, quote, followed. So then after getting the vaccine, we ask if you ever get a sickness that could be COVID, that we test to see if it's COVID. And then we compare how many people who got the vaccine get COVID versus the people who got placebo get COVID. And we assume if you got placebo, it's kind of the natural rate, meaning it's just what you would get in the community without any protection.
Right.
And then how much can the vaccine protect you? So, you know, if a family is trying to decide, should I do this or not? I mean, the most important thing is to start off, you know, looking at what the adult trials have shown in terms of safety and efficacy. And then the second is to, you know, talk to the researchers who are doing the studies. All of us who do these pediatric studies are pediatricians or pediatric infectious disease doctors or vaccinologists, as we call ourselves. So, like, we'll know all of the information. You'll get, we do a video first, so families get to watch, you know, understand what all the visits are and what the vaccines are about.
Right.
We have a long consent form that people read that tells you all about the risks and the benefits and all that. So there's a lot of good information there. In terms of,
I just want to cut in for a second because before we go too far away from it, you use the word placebo. I just want to make sure people understand what that means. You said it would be a sugar water. Can you just talk about that very quickly so people know exactly what that is?
Yeah, I mean, in clinical practice, if you just go to your doctor, you're not wanting them to prescribe to you, quote, sugar water or placebo or salt water, something that doesn't have any medicine in it.
Okay.
But when we do studies like this, we want to know, well, what are the side effects of the vaccine and what, how well does the vaccine work? And really the only way to do that is have some people be in what we call a control group.
Okay.
And that is, they're not getting anything. They're just getting, in this case, it's salt water. So, you know, you get an injection, it looks like the vaccine, it feels like the vaccine, but it doesn't have any vaccine in it. Because if we don't do that, what happens is, how do we know what proportion of people have sore arm or headache or fever? It's very hard if you don't have a group that didn't get the vaccine.
Okay.
So that's what we mean by a placebo. It's just a, you know, something that doesn't have any active ingredients in it. Now, what happens in these trials is, once we show that there's, that the vaccine looks like it's safe and effective, which may take a few months, then you get the the people who had gotten the placebo then get the vaccine.
Okay.
So it's not like you're not going to get it at all. It's just at the beginning of the trial, you don't get it.
Let me ask you a question, Dr. Campbell. One of the things that, that came out was that we were getting data that more African-American and Hispanic children who were contracting COVID-19 were dying. I think you said 150 children at the last number I'd received, and half of them were African-American and Hispanic children. Are you still seeing that play out? And if so, is that the real need to have more Black and brown children enrolled in this trial study?
Yeah, we unfortunately, Dr. K, we are. That is what we're still seeing. It's two things. One is it's a higher proportion of all the people who just even get infected are Black and Latinx people. And then of those people that get infected, including children, those who get the most severe complications from it are from communities of color. So it's both getting the disease and being severely affected. So it is important that we know that these vaccines or treatments or anything that we're testing works across all people, you know, people of all types, but especially important for Black and Latinx folks, because if you're in a group that's the most affected, then you want to, you know, we want to know that the prevention that we can potentially offer is going to work for you as well. That's why, you know, we also pushed at the beginning of these studies to make sure that, for example, elderly people were in the trials.
Right.
Because if we only had the evidence that it worked in young people, then how do we know that it works in old people? We wouldn't have known that. And the same, if we only know it works in white people, how do we know that it's going to work in black and brown people?
So, well, I have two more quick questions for you. I'm stepping because I know we're running out of time. And one is a simple yes or no, because it came through. People sent me this twice. They're like, I've gotten the vaccine. My parents have gotten the vaccine. Can I now go visit them? If you've both been vaccinated, are you okay to go to be together now?
So we do not want people letting their guard down while after being vaccinated. So they should be doing the exact same thing they were doing before, and that is physical distancing, wearing masks, hand hygiene, not being in congregate, exact same thing. So now once we, quote, reach herd immunity, and that's going to take about 3/4 of the U.S. population being having been infected or vaccinated, that's the point where we're going to be able to start loosening things up. For now, not only because of what I just said, but also because of these new variants that are spreading,
right. People
should be really careful. So,
okay. Now, my last question for you very quickly, because I know I have to go. The last question is that people, I know this, everyone has a question. The last question is that people are confused. They feel like every single day there's new information. No mask became wear a mask. Now it's double mask. So can you just let people know that maybe it's new information because we're still finding out things about it?
That's exactly what's going on. You know, when we have diseases that have been around since, you know, forever, we know a lot about them because we've been studying them for 50 years or 100 years. When we have COVID and it's only been around for a year, we're still learning. And I think we try to provide everyone the most accurate, up-to-date information, and that's what they're getting. So not only has it changed all year long, it's going to continue to change.
Okay.
So that's why people got to stay on top of things.
So, Dr. Campbell, if you had a child under the age of 15, would you put your child in the trial study for the COVID vaccine?
I would if they'd let me. So they don't let family members of investigators. I'm about to start a pediatric trial.
Okay.
And family members can't be in it. But just today, this morning, my son, who is 21, but has some developmental intellectual disabilities, just got his first vaccine. We've been trying to get it for a while, and we're so happy that he got it. But yes, I would put my child, especially this type of vaccine, I would definitely would put my younger child in it. But it's not for every family, and I don't think every family should think they have to or should put their children in these trials. But it is worth a look, you know, like investigate, see what it's all about, and see whether or not it's for you, because, you know, it does give you the opportunity to get the vaccine. One is to help society, and two is to get the vaccine for your child a little bit earlier than you would, you know, waiting for emergency use authorization.
All right, I got to stop it there. We're going to definitely invite you to come back. Dr. James Campbell is a professor of pediatrics and a pediatric infectious disease specialist at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. Thank you so much, Dr. Campbell.
You are welcome. Thanks for doing what you're doing.
Absolutely. Folks, stay with us. We'll talk more right after the break.